The problem is, you do see a lot of antisocial people succeed. Loneliness is as big a risk factor for ill health and death.
You know, we live inside our heads.
You go cold turkey, you go into withdrawal.
There is a lot of value in the stuff that we struggle with.
Better Thinking. Conversations with experts exploring all things psychology. Welcome back to Better Thinking. My name's Nish Nikolic, and my guest today is Dr. James Dunn. He is a postdoctoral fellow in the School of Psychology at UNSW Sydney. His current areas of interest include face and person recognition, forensic science, and individual differences with both applied and theory-inspired research using behavioral methods, machine learning, and eye tracking. Dr. Dunn's previous and current work explores strategies that support superior face identification accuracy and contextual influences on face identification. It was a great pleasure to speak with Dr. Dunn today about his experience looking at the identification of photos, in particular in Australian passports, and how there are individual differences between people with regards to being able to see differences or not be able to see differences. The applications are wide, and this particularly is fascinating to me as AI is expanding at such an incredible rate, and it's important to understand the mechanisms at play in this space. I hope you enjoy this episode because I like the technological connection that it has with psychology as well. James, a very big thank you for coming onto the program today.
Thanks for having me.
Look, I do have to admit I'm quite excited about today's conversation. I do have a little bit of a personal passion that intersects with psychology around, you know, the space of AI, the space of technology, and certainly how we've been using this, particularly with, you know, the world evolving quite immensely. And one of those spaces is things like face recognition, eye tracking, person recognition and the like. There is so many ways that I think this technology is going to be implemented in the future. And I'm interested in understanding a bit more about the psychology side of this so that I'm hopefully not blind to how this technology might be used. And in actual fact, how we are even looking at this space through, you know, a psychology lens. So I'm excited to be talking to you today.
Yeah, thank you. Really happy to talk about this topic. It's a great passion project of mine.
Let me start with, how did you get into this space? Because this is such a niche little segment, you know, that crosses over with psychology.
Yeah, I get this question a lot with students. I actually found I stumbled into this when I finished my undergraduate degree, having done an honors topic that was more targeted in neuroscience. I didn't really know what I wanted to do next. So, but there was a job being advertised at the university where I did my degree at UNSW on a specific project with the Australian Passport Office, looking at how to test their passport officers, the people who are verifying the photographs that you submit to the passport office to make sure that you are who you say you are when you apply for a passport or renewal. Looking at their performance and how to make them better. And I found that fascinating to do a project that had such a applied significance. I could explain to my family and friends immediately exactly what I was doing and they understood. And I just found that really, really cool. And from working on that project and going into my PhD and now since doing a PhD, just continually developing new understanding and how this problem is being solved and the new emerging problems, as you mentioned, with working with AI and those kinds of things.
It's even that's so fascinating to me because I have had a look at my passport quite recently alongside a new passport that a colleague of mine has had issued. And even though mine's only a few years old, the difference is quite stark. There's so much technology that goes into the Australian passport. It's absolutely ridiculous. And I only know some very, very, very surface level things, but I understand that there is an infinite amount of work that's gone into keeping it resistant to you know, fraudulent behavior of reproduction and so on. Am I able to ask a little bit about how what your work looked at in terms of how human beings validate these photos and make sure that people are real and so on? Can you speak to that at all?
Yeah, so when we first, the project actually predates my involvement, but I'll go back a little bit further that my collaborator, Associate Professor David White, did some of the first testing of the staff at Australian Passport Office with the idea of trying to understand how they're continually working in this problem, if that actually makes them better at this task. Have they become an expert? And the results were actually quite surprising, despite the fact that these people, these staff members were highly motivated to do well, that they had lots of training and experience in doing these kind of identity verification. They still made errors on a face matching test where they're comparing different, so they're comparing two different photographs to say if the same were different people. They made errors in one in every five trials. So that's 20% error rate. And that was equivalent to what students were getting on the same test. So despite the fact they had all this experience, they was making a significant number of errors, the same that a regular person we took a regular student sample were doing. And we couldn't also predict, some people were clearly better than others, but we couldn't predict those people based on things like experience or any other factor that we knew. So it just begged the question of, well, why are some people doing really well on this and some people doing really poorly? And why is error rate as high as it is? And so the continued research that we did on this area was trying to understand how we improve that system by selecting people who are actually naturally gifted at this task. So one of the things we learned from studying face recognition is actually it's a naturally varying ability. Some people are born with the ability to remember faces really, really well, and some people are quite poor. And it naturally begs, if you can pick people who are good at recognizing faces, then they will be better suited for these jobs. And that's exactly what happened. When I joined the project, we were testing the accuracy of a new team they created called the Identity Resolution Unit, who were the first team to receive more stringent training and also were selected based on ability. And they outperformed the regular passport officers who hadn't been selected on this, and vastly outperformed novices as well by at least 20% on depending on which test you look at.
So I suppose recruitment was very much based on selecting for those who have naturally improved ability. Obviously, there is probably, I'm assuming here, some upskilling, but a lot of this is just how you have been born. And I'm assuming that there's plenty of external factors that have maybe improved that, but we can't necessarily put our finger on that to amplify that. Or are there things that that you might know and be able to share as to what improves people's capacity to do face recognition?
So a large part of it does seem to be genetic. So there are twin studies showing that if you have identical twins versus non-identical twins, the identical twins have a larger similarity in a score in a face recognition test for the non-identical twins. In a sense, there's a large genetic component there. It's a largely heritable thing. We see it a lot with different populations, with the parents having similar ability to their children as well. If we have somebody who has really bad face recognition, a disorder known as prosopagnosia, it seems to be heritable. It turns up in their kids as well quite often. And so in that way, it does seem to be largely genetic. There is room for improvement, but it's at a much smaller scale than genetics does. So if we say genetics accounts for 20 to 30% of the differences we see in scores, versus training, we can improve people maybe 5%, maybe 10%, but it's, you know, half to a third of what the differences we see between the best and worst people on these tests. So we can move people around the margins, but we can't make up for what their gene pool was.
Yeah, wow. Wow. I imagine the implications of that means the way that we recruit for a position like that is very much based on a test that looks at how do you actually score.
Yeah.
Maybe for some personality things in terms of just how you're going to get along with other work work colleagues, but in terms of from a performance point of view, to be able to identify, with greater validity when there's a fake photograph presented, it's helpful to just do that purely on a objective test.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite a groundbreaking idea in a sense. It seems quite straightforward common sense, but it was a groundbreaking. Everyone thinks they're good at face recognition because everyone's used to recognizing their friends and family, these people they're really familiar with. But it's actually quite rare you actually have to recognize someone you don't know that well. And when you do, you don't often get feedback when you make mistakes or you kind of avoid those social scenarios. So in that way, we don't really get to find out we're bad at this task. And it's such a new thing. It's only really existed since photography has been around, because before, when you saw two people sitting next to each other, they had different heads attached to the body. They couldn't be the same person. So it's not until people first had photography that we could actually say, wait, this person looks different. Is it the same person as the person standing in front of me in this photograph? And so for that reason, we didn't really, it's not a problem we've evolved to solve. We evolved to solve familiar face recognition. And when passport officers are looking at photographs, they're almost never going to know who the person's face is. And that just makes it so difficult, because what we do is we clue into what makes up from becoming familiar, we clue into what makes somebody different from everyone else, what is unique about that person's face. But a photo is just, a single photo is just such a poor representation of that. We just struggle to compare images and decide whether that is that person or not, because things like lighting, age, there's a lot of factors that make someone look different to themselves. And for that reason, it's just a hard task, harder than we think it is.
Are there any particular signals that those who are good at seeing the difference, are they looking for differences? Are they looking for what's the same? Are they able to describe the process that they're going through to go out and say, this is why this is different? Have you had a look at that side of the research?
Yeah, so the more, since the creation of this identity resolution unit, we have spent a lot of time working with them. And although they have this natural ability to do this image comparison to say whether images are fake or not, in that sense, whether there's some fraud there, they do. Well, the training doesn't seem to, well, we can't explain exactly what's going on with this group, because when you give them a short course of training and identify particular skills, you can get small improvements. But what we find is, as a process of working in this group, in this team for a long period of time, we do see people get better. So they are learning something. And what we've pinned it down to is they use this kind of really unique, it's unique approach, but it's unique in a sense it's not how we normally recognize faces. So normally if I want to recognize someone's face, I just look at their face. I might look at and take it in one go and get a sense of what that person looks like. But what this forensic facial examiner team, the specialist team, have developed is a procedure where they compare individual features. They go between your left eye and another, the image, the comparison left eye, and they go back and forth. They compare the nose, they compare the ears, and they're drawing out similarities and differences between those images at a detail and minutiae that most people would never consider. They're talking about the upper, the tear duct region, the corner of the eyes, because it's got high contrast and acuity in those in images. You can compare those areas, the shape and contours of the ears and all these various things. So what those people are doing is breaking down the face into these very small parts for comparison. And that's different to how we normally recognize faces, but they're very good at it, and it makes them a lot better at on these tests we give them.
And are they doing that at a magnified level where, for example, an image is blown up, or is this something where, for example, you just give them a regular sized photo and you know, you're looking at with eye tracking they're doing this, or have they actually been specifically trained, look at their left eye and compare the left eye, look at the eyebrows, look at the nose, the left nostril versus the other left nostril. Is this something that you noticed first and then trained on that? Or is this something that kind of just came out of the research that through eye tracking, you were able to observe how they're doing the process of recognition?
It didn't come from the research. It was something that was developed as a result of trying to become a type of forensic science. So if you're gonna report on the procedures and present that information to court, you need to be able to describe what you're doing. And so part of that came down to this idea of feature by feature comparison, because it's quantifiable. You can report on distinct details. So in that way, it wasn't driven by the research. There was a first part of your question, though, I thought was really interesting, but I've lost track of it. Could you remind me do you remember what the first part you just said?
Let me think back myself. I have a tendency to ask three questions in one. I was talking about whether these images are blown up, whether they are magnified.
Yes. Yeah, so they would love to have really high resolution images. When they can get them, they use them, they zoom into every single pixel and grain, and they will do that. But actually, the constraint comes from the photograph that's in the passport. So if people don't know this, the passport has a little computer chip in it, and that computer chip is only so big. It can't really store a high resolution photo in there. It was limited by the technology when it was first developed. And it takes a really long time for international standards to allow for a high-resolution chip to then facilitate a high-resolution photo. So the chip that's stored in the passport is only, maybe 100 to 150 kilobytes or something like that. So a really compressed, really small photograph. So if you blow it up too big, you're going to get pixelation distortions because it's JPEG compression and all these different things. So they would love more quality. They can't get it. But what we find is, even though they don't have all the quality, they can still be very, very good, or at least better than how at the average Joe is.
And is there any machine learning or AI that you're aware of that is now potentially beginning to be involved in this process that, we're modeling off humans, or we're just maybe modeling off the computer science AI and however that works, to start taking over this? I mean, you were saying that obviously the regular average error rate is 1 in 5, 20%, at least for the regular person. A little bit better, obviously, for those who are genetically that way predisposed. Is there an AI component now that is at least in question, or that you're aware of that might be used?
Yeah. So AI's the organizations like the Passport Office, and I can't speak to how it's used across internationally, but I know this is probably not a completely uncommon case. AI in the sense of its facial recognition technology, it's a computer making facial comparison decisions. It's being used for at least 15, maybe even 20 years within the Passport Office. Early iterations of these programs, so they've used it a lot. And the reason why they have to use it is because there are millions of Australians. And if what they want to do is check whether when you apply for your passport, have you submitted a passport under another name using your photo? And so what they're going to do is they can't physically check every existing passport. They need some help. It's just impossible for humans to do this task. So they've asked computers, obviously, to help make that decision. And so a computer will take each new photograph that's been submitted to the passport office and check it against every other passport office image that's been submitted ever in electronic recording for the last 30, 40 years, whatever, and to check whether that person's the current passport image matches anything that exists. And if it does match, then it suggests someone's committing identity fraud, potentially. Sometimes there's innocent reasons why there's a duplicate entry data management problem that happens because of old entries. But most of the time, if there's a match, it's because someone's trying to commit fraud. And so those original systems were not as accurate as a human. Everybody knew that at the time. They were not very accurate, but you couldn't solve the problem without that technology. You couldn't even touch the scratch the surface of it. When we first started working in the passport office, they were still using this. They were using these systems, and it meant that when you have an AI searching a database for similar-looking people, the results it's going to return are quite challenging to compare. So they're going to find the person who looks most similar to you in the in Australia, basically. And that person might actually look quite similar to you, and you got to work out whether that person looks like your current passport image. So that is the nature of how AI contributes to this. It enables them to do something they couldn't do without it, but actually makes the problem harder. And since we started working with them about 10 years ago or 15 years ago now, the problem's actually gotten worse. AI is getting better. It's getting more accurate, and in some cases more accurate than humans, but it also means it picks out people who are even more similar looking to you or I. So it means that we're finding even better doppelgangers within this system, and that makes it even more challenging for these teams to review. Not to say that everyone has these doppelgangers, but they certainly do exist. You do have someone who looks quite like you somewhere else in Australia, more than likely.
Is that quite a common issue that comes up, that there's several, Nesh Nikoliks walking around, several Jameses walking around, several of each of us, because we have enough similar features, enough variation, and if our population's 25, 28, I don't know how many million, I imagine it would be even harder in the United States with 300 million. Is that usually a common occurrence, that there are probably lots of false positives, at least as a starting point, that they then get flagged because there's our double out there somewhere, or triple, I suppose.
Yeah. I think by statistically, it just has to be true. And I think you start to see these things now. We have a largely globalized and connected world. I think there's a website, is Find Your Doppelganger. And, there are people finding their internet twins, people who look so similar to them, and have never met and probably share no family relation, at least in any meaningful way in terms of generations. But these people who look exactly like them. And so in this way, when you have this many people and so little room for statistical variation, you're going to have people who are eventually going to start looking like each other. And I think you're right, it would be worse the more faces you have to look for at, the more problematic that would be in terms of returning similar people.
I can't imagine how this problem was even remotely mitigated previously without being able to put photos through a computer and get some type of match, because how could there is no human system that could do this in any other form that is even remotely reliable. There's just the volume of people makes it impossible. If someone's trying to be fraudulent, they're not going out and saying, oh, yeah, we both live in the same suburb. We both live in the same town. We're both born in the same, country, from wherever it might be, or here in Australia. It would be almost an impossible needle in a haystack type of scenario.
Yeah. Comes down to the other types of – so face is just one component of identity verification that the passport office is doing. It's become quite a strong one, but of course there are a lot of other elements in terms of document examination. The fact that you used to have to go to a passport office and verify yourself in front of somebody, post office, you used to have to go to a post office and they take the photo and and people are signing, all those various things come into part of the security checks they're doing. But of course, as you move into a more digital age of digital photography and alterations and all these things, this is actually introducing more opportunities for fraud than what was available before.
Especially with AI-generated images as well. Obviously, we're trying to maintain some sort of validity by saying the post office still needs to take the photo, which means there's a physical person being who's there, takes the photo. Having said that, maybe there's some technology in the photo itself and in the paper itself that is used specifically in post offices that tries to mitigate that. But I can imagine, you know, these days AI, looking at a program, even like video program like Sora that I've recently looked at, blows my mind you can basically make anything that's, you know, at least for my eye, is photorealistic.
Yeah.
You know, you could do 100 variations of me, and I bet it could just achieve that and make it look all so close that you know, even a trained human eye would probably not be able to see which one's the real one and which one's not.
Yeah, I mean, it's why people quite often ask, why can't I just take a photo of my phone and submit it? Why do I have to do these other checks and stuff? And honestly, you might have said 20 years ago that might have been fine if we had decent camera phones then. But the problem is technology has created this new problem. It's like, yeah, you can create a realistic fake of somebody else just at home. I remember talking to different people at the passport office, and they said some countries allow you to use Photoshop on your photographs that you submit, so to beautify yourself, which of course has a dramatic effect on some certain particular features or skin smoothing if you're looking for things like marks and blemishes, which you can use to identify somebody. Quite identifying features, but you smooth them out, then they're gone. There are genuine alterations people can, like cosmetic surgery, and quite often people who get that travel of letters explain why their features have changed from a doctor's note to say, hey, my face looks different from my passport before because I've had cosmetic surgery. But if somebody's getting their photo digitally altered, there's almost no record of how that's transformed the face. Which makes it very difficult, especially if you're going to rely on an automated system. That one thing that automated systems don't have that humans can do is context. We can take context into account. I can tell you that I've had cosmetic surgery. I can't tell a computer you've had cosmetic surgery. It doesn't know what to do with that information.
Mm.
So humans, at the end of the day, are context savvy, and that's why all problems that can't be solved by a computer go to a human, and all challenging decisions are reviewed by humans. And this why this forensic team is so important, because they're the highest echelon of review. They're the high court for the passport enrollment process, basically. They're the ones all the hard problems go to that set the ground rules for everyone else.
And what an incredibly difficult problem as well, with the volume of change that people can now do to their faces, if we, you know, specifically continue to look at that. You know, whether it's fillers that people are putting all through their face, whether it's, you know, lips and different areas of their face, the way that we do our eyebrows, you know, changes immensely. People are getting Botox, which might change.
Just losing weight's another one. Yeah,
what's that, sorry?
Losing weight's another one. If you lose weight, that can change the shape of your face. Yeah.
We can go out and, I mean, they don't let you smile, but I suppose, you know, a smile would be problematic as well in terms of how you smile can be very different. But, you know, you can change your teeth so easily these days as well. There's an infinite number of variations, I suppose.
Absolutely. And we knew the not smiling thing, I think, came a lot from the early face recognition AI that were being used, where if somebody was wearing glasses, because you weren't allowed to wear glasses in the photograph too, if somebody was wearing glasses or they were smiling, they were much more likely just to return a photo in the system that matched, because it was a smile or of glasses. They created a greater sense of false alarms. It wasn't fooling the system, but it would confuse the system in a sense. Now the new systems they're using, much more robust of these kind of changes. They don't care whether your head is slightly tilted, whether you're smiling, whether you're still, glasses might be a little bit of a problem, but not so much. It can do all the system is much more robust of these superficial changes. That said, the cosmetic surgery is still a genuinely curiosity in terms of how much that affects things. But the more general stuff that most of us go through, it doesn't affect these newer systems much.
I wonder if there's anything about a smiling face versus a, you know, very flat face, in terms of, I know that from a leniency point of view, someone who's smiling at you is much more pleasant to look at than someone who is frowning or is flat-faced, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Whether a nice smile might might affect us psychologically, and just say, oh, you know, they've got a nice smile, I'm feeling in a better mood.
I suppose I always thought about it like, what mood am I going to be when I'm flashing this passport in the office? If I have to go through the line, I'm going to be in a grumpy mood, jet lag. So I think it's much better that I'm not smiling, because that's probably what I'm going to look like in the photo.
That's a good point. That's a good point. Can you talk me through a little bit about the, and I'm not sure if it's a condition, but the known experience of prosopagnosia?
That's the one. Yeah.
I haven't heard that before. You're saying that's when people have a deficiency in being able, maybe not, that's not the right word, but a struggle in being able to recognize faces or recall faces or remember them.
Yeah. So prosopagnosia, you got that right. It's also called face blindness interchangeably. It's a congenital disorder. So it's something that some people are just born with. Some people can acquire it from strokes or other brain damage, but some people are just born this way. And it is exactly what you describe. It's the inability to recognize faces, even people who they have a lot of exposure to. So in the same way you and I don't struggle to recognize friends and family, they do. They talk about the fact that they can't recognize their partners and significant others and family based on their face alone. They're using other information. They can still recognize them, but just not based on the face, or at least very poorly.
And that also is very genetic in nature, like the other scenario of trying to upskill someone that's got a limited capacity. I'm assuming something similar occurs for face blindness. Is that?
It's quite heritable too. Yeah,
people for someone to pick up. Sorry.
Yeah, it's you can't really. It does seem like it's not something you can train away. People do find coping mechanisms, tuning into clothes and hair and those kind of things, but it's not necessarily something that can just be overcome simply. They quite often report this has a dramatic effect on their social relationships, particularly in workplaces where people expect a certain level of familiarity and camaraderie for colleagues and stuff like that. But without the context of knowing where somebody is, they find it quite difficult to know it's somebody they met before or not. So some people go to conferences and it's a completely unfamiliar environment in that sense. You don't know who you're going to see. Therefore, you're not going to be able to recall that must be this person who's talking to me now. It's a bit different when you're walking down an office space and you know where people sit at their desk, because you can go, oh yeah, this must be Joe. He's sitting at Joe's desk. But quite often they also tell me, oh, one day Joe wasn't sitting at his desk. Fred was sitting at his desk and I said, hi, Joe. Or I said, I don't know who you are. And it was somebody who I did know that is at a different desk. So it can be quite quite interesting in that way. It was a social encounters, the profound impact that can have on how they interact with other people.
Wow. That must be, I'm assuming, quite rare in its severe form, I suppose, where you're at that level where you've seen someone, you know, 100 times over, you know, 6 months, yet you can't recall who they are. You know, if they swap desks, that you're still confused as to who it is because you're expecting Joe to be there.
Yeah, we're talking maybe 2%, maybe 1% of the population, just a really rare section, yeah.
Incredible. Is there any relationship with conditions that are similar to like ASD, where some people might have difficulty with recognition of emotions? That obviously face and emotions, where there's any sort of overlap there or they're quite separate. Is there any sort of research looking at correlations between the two?
Yeah. So they, for a large part, they seem to be independent from each other in the sense that autism people who have prosopagnosia not automatically on the spectrum with autism, but you do see some overlap in the sense that some ASD people do have deficiencies in recognizing faces as well. They are on average lower in face recognition ability, but it's not necessarily. We also see some cases where there's people who are on the, who are on the autism spectrum, but are also super recognizers, people who are the complete opposite to this prosopagnosia, who almost never forget a face.
It's so fascinating. You know, I feel like I am reasonable at just general face recognition. And obviously I see lots of people in my work with clients, and I can almost, I can very quickly see someone's face and get their whole story in my mind. Mm-hmm. But if you ask me what their name is, even if I've seen them for several years, I'd struggle. And so in my calendar, I will look at people's names, and unless they're quite frequent, will be very, very difficult for me to capture who it is, because it just kind of gets, I suppose, muddled with all the other names. But the face gives me all of it. And I could just read, for example, my very, very first clinical notes, my entry to my first clinical notes, and I could read the first paragraph and a half, and I just know it all if I'm stuck, which is fascinating. There's obviously some triggers in my brain. And similarly, for some people, there's a visual trigger. There's maybe deficiencies in one, but you know, quite good in another. And it's just fascinating to hear how different we're organized, you know, as humans.
Yeah, I think what your experience is there, I think, is not that uncommon. I find that for myself. I struggle with names, but I quite often can tell whether somebody's familiar to me, and I can usually work out where it's from, where it's likely to be from context or from other information. But I think we should acknowledge that probably two different skills. You know, recognizing someone is a very much a visual thing. A name is a little semantic label. They're mentioned once in a passing in a sentence. You're expected to remember when you're trying to remember other things, and then usually forget that and moved on. The number of times who I've it happens all the time, people introduce themselves, and that's the one information I can't retain about them, but I can tell you where they work, who they have a relation to, because that forms part of their identity. The name is such a little part of that. It's one little fact, and you're not, it's very specific, and it is very hard to remember. And in this is why in psychology, cognitive models, the name and the face are stored in completely different places and completely different representations in that way.
It's fascinating. Also, just reflecting on myself, there's almost like a sense of stress or a sense of nervousness about remembering someone's name. And that might be learnt over time, and therefore it's been reinforced. It might be just something that cognitively is harder for me to recall. But whatever it is, there is some type of pressure around that.
Yeah.
Yet I've never in my life ever considered trying to encode someone's face. You know, that just happens so automatically. I don't have to do any recall, don't have to remember. And it's probably something that, just from an evolutionary perspective, makes a lot of sense. You probably do need to know whether a face is friendly or if it's unfriendly, and it's best you kind of remember that very rapidly. You don't have to kind of encode that several times over. Otherwise, you know, that might be the end of you. So at least from an evolutionary point, it sounds like that would be a reasonable design.
I think so. And I think faces offer, as you say, from an evolutionary point of view, such a wealth of information. We learn so much about who somebody is and what their intentions are from the face, both emotions and personality. Whether correct or incorrect, there's a large agreement in how people rate a particular person's face on these personality dimensions. Whether it's ultimately true is not the point. The point is people will view a face and they'll agree. Is this face more trustworthy or not? So we're capping into something. Now, that something may not actually predict their personality, but we're all cluing into that, and that tells us just such rich information we're relying on to make these judgments.
And what's What are the other applications of face recognition that is being used in the world that's, other than identity type of scenarios? Where else does this research get used, and is it applicable?
Well, the facial recognition is very much an identity problem. There are a lot of different aspects where it's being applied, not just within identity verification per se for passports, but we've done different work with people who historically have gone through archive images and trying to track criminal movements in criminal anthropology, trying to track, is this the same criminal pictured in these different photographs? And so we can use face recognition technology or these human experts to try and work out if this person is the same one in all these different images, because that t tells part of their story as they move through different countries or whatever, for cultural reasons, for anthropo but I guess, there's more commercial, more recent aspects to it. Face recognition is used for identity verification on phones. It's being used to track people in countries by organizations, businesses. Somewhat controversially, there's the case with Bunnings recently, and other places that are using face recognition. So it's something that pops up quite a bit. Not always because people want to know, is this Bill? But instead, what they want to know is this person A the same person who's been here before and did XYZ? There's a lot of things you can gain from not having that information.
I imagine the further we go into this space, the more ethical considerations that arise. And particularly with the volume of cameras that we have, for example, as the definition of cameras improves and storage, and the capacity of machine learning to and AI in particular to recognize one's behaviors, one's locations, one's temperaments, even from a Bunnings point of view, what are you interested in? Are you spending time in, the hardware part or the gardening part, and how that might, what that might say about you that at the moment might sound very minor as a concern. Who cares that I'm doing some gardening on a weekend? But when we put that together with so much more other information, or if it were used with other information, it could be potentially abused in, I imagine, infinite number of ways. But do you have any concerns about, and I know that you're not an ethicist or anything like that, but do you have concerns about the future with regards to face recognition and particularly the automated side? Because I think humans have great challenges in being able to sift through so much data versus an AI mechanism architecture that can do it, given a set of parameters as to what information it's trying to collect or uncover.
I think the one of the feeds into this is public perception, whereas great concern about who's using technology, and inherent trust that the technology is reliable and accurate. And I feel like that is almost misguided in a lot of sense. I think people should be more concerned about the accuracy and validity and reliability of the technology, and less probably not concerned, but less concerned about who's using it. Because in a lot of cases, the people who are using it, as long as they're upfront about what the that's a legal sense, legal problem in a sense. They have to specify what they're going to use it for. I think that comes down, that's a different problem. people, I will answer that particular point. People should have to specify what they're collecting data for and what they're going to use it for. And that should limit the scope, because the problem with some of these organizations is they're collecting data without any knowledge about what they're going to do with it, how they're going to store it. And that can lead them to doing things which the system is not capable of doing. And for example, they may be running, they might be wanting to track how far people walk through the store. But from that, they get access to some system that tells them how they can use that to work out how emotive people are, whether they're happy or sad. And it's not clear whether those two things are accurate or connected at all. But the system claims it can do it. Now, this is where it comes back to my first point. People have too much trust in the validity and accuracy of these systems. Because we have our certain exposures to it leads us to think it might be better than what it is. Your daily person may use Face ID on their phone. Face ID on a phone is a low risk situation where they've taken a photo on a controlled setting on their phone, and then that phone is then taking another photo later and comparing it to that single photo. One to one comparison, very easy for face recognition AI to do. And the worst is it doesn't like that photo. It just takes another one, or it says your face doesn't look very good today. Put in a pin or something else. Low risk, low stakes. The broader, higher stakes setting, SmartGate. SmartGate has a very specific setting on its camera. It knows exactly how far the person is away. It knows the exact lighting conditions that are set up with it. It tells you to remove the glasses, look neutral. And in those circumstances, it can be very, very accurate comparing you to your photo. But if it's not sure, if it's less than, say, 95% sure, whatever the threshold they set on those systems, that's a secret, that's not something we know, then it sends it to a human person in a line. So that way a human's going to verify that. So again, the stakes of getting it wrong is just wasting someone's time, but low stakes. So in those controlled environments, it can be a very accurate and highly reliable system. What we don't know is how reliable the system's going to be when using CCD footage. Because when we don't train the systems for those kind of problems, CCD cameras are high in the sky, they're looking down, they're poor resolution, poor lighting, and research suggests that is actually the worst angle possible, up, down, looking from the top, looking down, to recognize a person's face. And so for that reason, it makes it very challenging to say that if police are taking CCTV footage and running it through an algorithm to say this person's a match, if that's the only evidence they have to go off, that's a very poor form of evidence. It's not very compelling. But people are very scared of these systems and they trust the accuracy too much. And so somebody reports, they think it just reports match, and that means it must be this person, but actually it's much more less accurate than that.
I imagine the issue today is more so the quality of a photo than it is the other technological constraints. If videos could actually have high bandwidth capture, then you wouldn't have nearly as much problems, except we don't all have Hollywood capture cameras at every angle that then goes out and says we've got this astronomical, you know, highly dense raw file that you could actually zoom in so much that you're not going to find that pixelation. Everyone's running these. It kind of looks good on your screen, but it's pixelated the moment you do something at, you know, more than a meter away or whatever it might be. And so at least from today's technology, it doesn't seem like there's too much concern. At least that reliability and accuracy is pretty low. But if you do a very, very confined, controlled scenario, like, you know, your phone using passcode, then it's like, fantastic, this is the best invention. You know, I don't have to go out and try and use a third party passwords scenario or whatever it might be. And it must be very reliable, because the cost would be astronomical if people's finances were being cracked all the time. through this sort of scenario. And, you know, it requires you to have a phone, it requires you to have the right face, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes. So that's the added security feature, is physical access to it, and assumes you can block things like that if people, four people can work out who you are and how to steal your face. So, yeah.
But I imagine where people might be a little bit hesitant is you know, the fear of the future, you know, mm-hmm. how it might be used in a way that it maybe wasn't intended to. But at least for today, it doesn't sound like, at least for you, there's any specific alarm bells because the technology is not there. You know, you have to kind of go to the post office and say, under these perfect conditions, take a photo. And even half the time they reject your photo, then they say, you got to do it again.
Yeah, exactly. I wouldn't say that there's zero fear. I think the problem is the misconception is not just in public, but some, I'm not going to name any specific groups, but some police forces, for example, don't have the full understanding of the technology they're using. And so there have been some cases, more so in America, because those are the ones that gain publicity, of people who have been exonerated or have been had their cases challenged in court because the photo ID evidence turns out it was made under poor quality decisions, basically. Somebody has run a photo through a system, it's returned 1,000 results, and on a person 140, they think that person matches, and they've gone and arrested that person. And so, I mean, sometimes this technology can help provide investigative leads, but just because somebody matches on a database should not be taken as any incriminating evidence in itself, I think, has been where it's been misused.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like one of those scenarios where technology has to catch up before you can go out and say, we've got reliability, we've got accuracy that we can actually point to scientifically, where there are experts that not only can validate it, they've demonstrated that validity over time. And it's not just one person's word, because we're talking about very real and genuine and serious cases. It's very minor. If it's, you know, getting an identity card for your school, you know, your school ID or something, even though that's still fraud, the concern isn't as great, because no one's going to go out and say, we'll take that photo to put on your passport. You've got to produce a brand new one that's obviously relevant. 6 months is the latest it can be, you know,
exactly.
How far away it is, et cetera.
Yeah. I think the other thing I think people don't understand about the AI, facial recognition AI, is that we don't actually understand how they work necessarily. It's a bit of a description, is kind of, it's a black box. What people do is they train these algorithms on all the faces they can get a hands on, and that could be millions of photographs taken from the internet. You may have heard of controversies like Clearview AI and these people who are developing these face recognition AI systems. And what they're doing is they're taking photographs that are on Google Images or on public databases like Flickr or whatever, and they're using that to train these algorithms. But once you do the training, those data is quite often deleted. People are quite concerned about that, but usually that data is deleted and it's removed from the algorithm itself. And then what you're left with is a algorithm that's been trained on existing data on how to identify faces, without knowing exactly who anyone is. It just says whether this person is more or less similar than another person. But what we don't know is, when it makes those decisions, how it came to that conclusion. So I started at the very beginning about these examiners, and I said one of the things that was really important for them was to develop a technique which they can report on in courts. They could go and say, I've used the eyes, and based on these 6 points of similarity, I think these are the same person. We can't do the same thing to an algorithm. We can't interrogate it. You can design programs that allow you to see what algorithms are trying to do, but it turns out as humans, when we look at that, we don't know how to make heads or tails in it, and we just inherently trust what they're doing, even when it makes an error. So there's a lot of trust in that sense as well, in what it's doing, but it's very murky and very hard to know and predict when this algorithm is going to make an error.
There's no way to validate it other than to use a human again.
Because
if it's in the black box, it's purely just trust again, versus saying, I actually know this one is a false positive and this is how I know why. But the computer has gone out and done the opposite, or has identified it as the opposite. And in here, we, you know, in here lies the problem. And how do we then, you know, remedy that? We don't know how it's actually doing it. Kind of like the Go scenario with AI. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the, you know, DeepMind played chess, and then, you know, another AI version went out and played the very famous game of Go. And in, you know, in both instances, eventually AI got to a situation where it was making brand new moves that humans had never made previously, that now humans have adopted and started to use, but they don't understand why it was made in the first place, but it does still have utility. So, you know, there are grandmasters that are using moves that they've seen AI do that have been unbelievable, but they still don't understand why, but they use it nonetheless. It's such a weird space to kind of consider. We're moving into a space potentially where AI will say these two images are different, but we won't know why, or they're the same and we don't know. Can't validate either direction.
And I think one of those cases with the Go, because it's such a complex game, and I think one of the first times that happened where it made a move that surprised the opponent, the human master opponent, it actually made it out of error. It was like more of a computational error, but it surprised the other person so much they retired from the game on the spot because they just didn't know how to handle that move. So it was more out of fear, again, about these computer systems than it was about the actual strength of the move itself. Not to say that that was one of the very early iterations, but of course they're very good now.
And it's fascinating to watch because I know, you know, particularly in chess, for example, the commentators in chess will have the AI equivalent screen going on saying AI is suggesting to do this as the most optimal move. Mm-hmm. What did the player actually do? And players will then go back on their game and look at what AI would have done, because AI, you know, far exceeds the human chess player. Mm-hmm. And so now we're learning something that we, you know, is in the black box. And that's kind of scary when we start looking at these real world applications. Like, a game is a game. Who cares, right? As a matter of fact, awesome. That's really fascinating, interesting. It has some real world ethical concerns and considerations when potentially, you know, how someone might, why someone might want to have a different identity and how they might use that, or, mm-hmm. you know, whether it's even against their own selves. There's just an infinite number of possibilities that don't necessarily come to mind, but, you know, identity is so key to us as humans.
Yes. It's so key. It's becoming even more important now to protect our digital identity. Because the access it can get somebody else in the wrong hands, in terms of somebody can be on the other side of the world and access all this information about you if your digital identity is compromised, or create duplicate identities or a whole new identity using some of your real details. That element is frightening. There are these bad antagonists trying to do this constantly. So people have a right to be cautious about protecting their digital identity and should, be more careful about these kind of things.
It's fascinating to kind of look at this, that we are still on a single photo scenario with key markers that, you know, might be about, you know, the space between the eyes and the ear, the eye duct, and so on and so forth. Maybe the future will hold identity on a video scenario where there's potentially more micro expressions that we do as human beings. I know as a clinician, I will see micro expressions in clients, particularly when there's something sensitive being discussed. It might be a pause. It might be, you know, a bit of a squint. There's often things that I will follow up on, you know, and I might actually ask a client, you know, you kind of paused there. Was there something that happened there? You know, and that's usually where I find tears or, you know, some hurt or pain or whatever it might be. I imagine that one day the way that we try and secure some of this stuff might be also micro expressions and the like that could potentially, you know, help where instead of saying take a photo, there might be, you know, have a conversation and we'll take 30 minutes of your conversation with a loved one, you know, answer these 35 questions or something. And that gets submitted to be more about your identity rather than a single photo. I'm just kind of speculating here.
I know. I think that's fair. I think one of the things we've experienced with all these deep fake faces is seeing somebody's face do something they don't normally do. Although it looks real, the face, there is a sense where the expression underlying the face that's been mapped onto seems a bit uncanny. And we know, despite having no personal familiarity with some of these celebrities that are doing it, it does seem a bit weird. And your brain does a lot to fill those gaps in. But if we have a more objective system analyzing it, then maybe it can notice that there's a discrepancy there. Or maybe it is about a human who looks at it and goes, no, this feels a bit off. That said, we're doing a bit of research in a lab about these AI-generated faces you mentioned before, and it turns out people believe AI-generated faces are more human than the human faces. So you give them a task and ask them, is this face AI-generated or real? People will say real more to AI faces than they do to real faces in that task. And it's only going to get worse as these algorithms get better and better.
Any hypothesis as to why, what's the explanation there? That blows my mind.
I think there's an association that people have that AI generated faces have irregularities, asymmetries, weird distortions and stuff like that. But actually there are some AI faces that will have, if you've seen some of the really bad ones, you'll see some weird distortions, stretched ears, elongated faces and stuff like that. But the half decent algorithm doesn't produce those very regularly. And in fact, people seem to have more asymmetries and irregularities than what the AI faces do now. And people are also judging these AI faces as more trustworthy than a real person because they may be slightly more attractive or slightly typical, less distinctive. They also quite often might be more representative of the demographic they're trained on, which is predominantly white males or definitely white faces, which may affect how they're being judged because of racial biases, implicit or explicit. And there's an absolute flow-on effect of that. So people are now able to generate an AI face and use it to create a social media profile. I mean, you've heard of completely AI influencers now, completely fake profiles that are out there with millions of followers. Everyone thinks they're real, but they're actually completely generated, synthetic faces. It's incredible.
Wow. It's incredible. I suppose I've seen both instances, but I have been aware of both instances. I think, you know, there's a classic one, like even not too long ago. I mean, it was a video and it was a bit easier to pick up on, you know, it was during a SpaceX launch where clearly some scammers had created a video to kind of, you know, show that it was the same thing. And they had Elon Musk get up on stage and he started to spruik some sort of cryptocurrency. And you could immediately go, wait a second. This is not the launch, right? So it's very easy to go and observe that. And they didn't show him close up or anything like that. And so you kind of see it from a mile away, you know, and they try and disguise it with his voice. But the voice was actually quite remarkably solid. Yet I've also seen, you know, AI-generated ones where they've taken a famous person, a celebrity, and had them speak and at least for me, unless someone told me this is an AI-generated segment, how would I know the difference? It was well done, you know, both from a voice and from a visual. You know, it's absolutely scary as to what is, at least in a controlled setting, achievable. At today's standard or today's technology.
Absolutely. I've seen an instance where you can record yourself speaking, you know, a happy birthday message in English, and then it gets an AI will dub you speaking into another language, and also adjust your lip movement so it looks like you're actually speaking the other language as well. And it's not that bad. And I could say these are early iterations of these kind of technology. It surely can only get better from here. It's crazy to think. And I mean, the person I saw did this assumes what they were saying was correctly translated, but you could imagine all kinds of insidious things where somebody gets their voice changed into something they didn't say in another language and relying on translation back. Or yeah,
it almost feels like we have other than a technological defense, we as humans are going to struggle, you know, other than the psychology of saying, unless I can verify this. I mean, let me take a couple of steps back. I'm getting a little bit excited. It feels like there's a real risk there. At the same time, that risk has kind of been true anyway, in terms of we've viewed television as though it's been honest. And I think we can comfortably say that history has demonstrated that the news has been dishonest over and over and over and over again. But as humans, we tend to just believe what our eyes see, what our ears hear, and we call that true. You know, if it's that whole thing, you know, oh, I read this on the internet, it must be true. You know, I saw this on the news, it must be true. Versus maybe our defense becomes, I'm going to be cautious with everything, you know, and unless I have a better means of validating, you know, like for me, for example, I'm skeptical about journals these days because of the replication crisis. It is, you know, I don't care that it was in, you know, JAMA or Lancet. Half of it, at least in the humanities, more than half, is bogus according to the replication crisis, that we can't actually go out and replicate it. So it says something. We've got to be cautious at least. And someone like me, I don't have the skill set to know which one is and which one's not. So therefore, I have to just be a little bit I need to pause before I go out and adopt a position.
I think that's a really important point. Yeah, a healthy level of skepticism. I feel like if anyone could take anything from what we learn as training for psychology, and is through being scrupulous of science and scientific methods, is just being skeptical about questioning things, how they're done, what's the, if there's agenda and all these kind of things, just more broadly. I'll also say you touch on probably a much bigger point, but also people, especially with the media stuff, but people have an assumption that when they ask photo or a video always tells the absolute truth. There's no bias in it. But anyone who has made a film, anyone in the film industry can tell you how easy it is to manipulate perspective and opinion based on perspective, and how it's great, how much it can affect your interpretation of events. If you ever watch a sporting match and notice the difference between two different replay reviews and how different that can impact the interpretation of whether somebody intentionally hurts someone or not. That's just a snippet of what happens with images and videos that are presented to in forensic settings, for example, stuff that's being presented in courtrooms, in wider cases, body-worn camera footage, other CCTV footage. People think that those kind of things can't lie, but that's, I think, a misguided, naive view of how videos actually work and the psychology behind how we interpret videos and photos.
It's maybe a big important part of what underpins psychology is trying to refrain from judgment and pause and actually spend more time curious and trying to understand rather than jumping to conclusions and assumptions. You know, what's interesting is that most people are plagued by a whole lot of worries and anxieties and concerns that never occur. They occur a million times in their mind, but only occur once in a lifetime, or you know, or in a year, or whatever the time frame is. But they're feeling that all the time, and it's fascinating that we have this additional bias, confirmation bias, and our eyes are so powerful. You know, we tend to believe our eyes so much. I imagine, you know, a large portion of the brain is wired to this particular sense, that and obviously for evolutionary purposes it becomes incredibly valuable, but now that could potentially also be attacked. Maybe it's the wrong word, but I'll use it anyway because I can't think of anything else. But we could go out and leverage that mm-hmm. bias in human beings, particularly with face recognition, you know, understanding how we can be tricked, you know, along with the other modalities as well. What are you currently working on?
So most of my main research lately has been between looking at super recognizers, these people who are naturally gifted. We've been bringing into the lab, doing additional testing on their face recognition abilities, what are the limits, but also trying to see how their abilities connect to their brain activation patterns. So putting them in EEG scanners and fMRI scanners to see what are the other parts of the brain that contribute to this ability. Is it just one specific part, or is it a wider network of activation? So we're just starting to scrape the surface, understanding why these people are better than the average person and so good at remembering faces. So that's been one element of my research. The other area I've been drawn to lately is actually looking at this problem about attention and memory. So we're tapping into this idea of people don't remember things perfectly. And obviously that has wide-reaching applications in every part of life, but I've been looking at more recently in police settings and looking at how stress, for example, affects what people pay attention to when certain incidents are happening, critical incidents, and how that may affect their memory. So I've been working on a project, luckily, with the Australian Federal Police, investigating that line of research using eye tracking and other cognitive tests as well.
And how do you go about designing those? Are you specifically trying to support, for example, a AFP need, or trying to more broadly understand the mechanisms at play that will then have an application? You know, is it going one direction or the other, or both?
In this case, it's the latter. I was fortunate to receive funding that is directed at that larger question of how this interacts more generally. But it also the grant program offered opportunity to collaborate specifically with this organization as a group to do this research with, as a collaborative partner. So I've been very lucky to work with them because they've opened doors and opportunities. We can do realistic stress testing. So we're not just sitting in a lab and saying, you should feel nervous, and making people dip hands in ice water, which is the main way we make people stressed in the lab. We're actually testing police officers while they're doing highly stressful training, in threat assessment training. And so in that moment, we get an opportunity to dive into exactly how they assess threat, and the decisions and what things they remember about it afterwards. And so that's really valuable because that's a highly realistic scenario there.
I imagine it must be so fascinating because at least for me, and please apologies for the naiveness, but it seems to me like anything could come up. You know, when you're reviewing how people do memory, how they attend, tracking eye movements, anything could come up. Something so obscure could show up in terms of how, you know, one person potentially, you know, who's an outlier, has a whole different sequence of eye tracking that shows different to how they, you know, perform under particular conditions versus, you know, most other people or whatever it might be. It must be fascinating to just have so much data and do it under proper stress, you know, to
Absolutely.
Examine this stuff.
Yeah, I get very used to the question of, am I weird when I do this? After studying face recognition for 15 years, a lot of people come up to me, am I weird because I do this to recognize faces? Same thing happens in these things. Am I weird because I don't remember this or because I remember this? Is it weird that when I'm stressed, I do this or don't do this? Or, yeah, it is so much individual variation to how people respond to these things. And I mean, one of the key things I'm interested in is seeing what that with that individual variation, what are the predictors of success, as how we should be measuring it, with the accuracy of which memory is being recalled, with the speed at which decisions are being reached. Are those things in agreement with each other, or actually are they opposite? Do the people who are faster responding to threat actually going to be worse at remembering it because they're attending less in a different way at the time. I've heard of cases with the police with previous training programs where they've had multiple attackers, and because there was a major threat and a more minor threat, they actually, in this instance, under high stress, didn't actually remember engaging the minor threat in this training scenario, and only remember the major threat because in the sequence of events, that was an afterthought in a sense. And you almost ask the question of, well, how could they forget these things? But you're asking them to do something that's so cognitively demanding, and I think the expectation is almost unfair, that they should remember everything perfectly. And yeah, so that's one of those interesting gaps we've been able to look at.
It's fascinating because there are those links, and I just link things together where they're actually connected or not is another thing. But we do obviously see in PTSD type scenarios or high trauma scenarios, high stress scenarios, what we attend to is so unknown. You can completely forget certain things, even things prior to an event can be lost. You don't even encode them, which is fascinating for me. So just knowing the phenomena is interesting in and of itself, not necessarily knowing how it's going to show up. I was going to actually ask a quick question around any phenomena around eye tracking, because that's at least, for me, I've never once in my life conceived or thought about how am I eye tracking? That's just an automated thing that occurs. No different to I don't ask myself how do I breathe. I just breathe. Maybe when I'm running, I might test some different versions of breathing. I usually mess it up and go back to your norm. But with eye tracking, are there any phenomena that those super recognizers do, or the average person even does? Because that, is interesting. Watching people's eyes.
I mean, people's eyes are moving constantly. They're taking in lots of information, little minutiae movements. It's fascinating when you start breaking down what we actually see and perceive, and the difference between perception and cognition and these kind of things. It's fascinating. To answer your question more specifically about the super recognizers and these other groups, we do see differences in their eye gaze behaviors when looking at faces. Particularly, super recognizers seem to be more active or behave more differently when learning the face initially, than it is about recognition. So when they're encoding the face, it seems that they're doing what we could describe as more visual exploration. They're actually engaging and exploring the face, moving their eyes across the face more. Whereas other people, the ordinary person seems to look more centrally, but also a little more just the eyes. If they're going to pay attention to features, a lot of attention to the eyes. This, I will say, in the context is when we ask super recognizers to learn and recognize a face. So we are asking them, hey, commit this face to memory. It's not what do you look at in a conversational sense. That research is still ongoing, but in this scenario, yeah, we do see their attender features differently than the average person.
Oh, so fascinating. So fascinating. I could talk forever about this because the applications are so wide. There's so many questions to ask, and I hope that these questions do continue to be asked and researched because the applicability is I think, quite great, particularly and maybe even more so now with AI and trying to understand how to do this. For those who would like to continue on with this conversation, any resources that you could offer, websites, any work that you're working on books and the like that listeners can read further into and continue that curiosity.
Absolutely. So the research lab I'm a part of at the University of New South Wales, we do have a website where we have links to some of our critical papers, if the stuff that I've said you want to draw look more deeply into. But we're also looking for people to participate in our research, both people who are potentially super recognizers, who are really good at remembering faces, and those people who could maybe prosopagnosic or struggle to remember faces. So we have online a free test you can do called the UNSW face test, and you could just Google search that. It will come up, and if you do that test, it'll tell you a result at the end, and that may indicate whether you're a super recognizer or not. But we ask people as well to leave their they can leave their email address as part of that test and sign up to our research registry, where we send them out with additional tests as we kind of dive more deeply into understanding, you know, this face recognition ability and how it differs with people. And if people are around Sydney, we might even invite you to come in and be part of those studies I mentioned, where we're scanning brains and doing different other activities as well. So lots of opportunities to engage in the research there.
Amazing. So that was UNSW face test, did you say?
Exactly. Yeah.
Perfect. Perfect. Amazing. Amazing. Thank you, James. I genuinely appreciate your time. It's so niched, which is what I love about these conversations. Mm-hmm. You know, people just don't hear about this. I certainly enjoy this immensely because the amount of work that goes into these small little things, I think, is what makes it so special, because the applications are immense. It's just that most of us don't ever recognize the efforts that go behind the scenes, and hence why, research is so interesting. So James, I appreciate you and your work, and thank you very much for your time today, and all the best with your ongoing research. I'll be definitely getting onto that UNSW face test to see how I fare. So maybe I might even become one of your participants.
Oh, thank you so much. And thanks for having me, and great conversation. Yeah, really interesting.